episode of The Socialist Shelf. This is part two of our jungle discussion with D. Mason. And without further ado, we're going to hop right back into it. So hold on, because we're going back to the stockyards of Chicago.
And there is like the element of the family being immigrants here and having that language barrier as part of it. But because of the time period, because these working districts were so immigrant heavy, it actually doesn't, I don't think them being Lithuanian actually holds them back all that much in the context of this book. I think if he had gone anywhere else, he would have had trouble. But in the meatpacking district, it is like an immigrant district, you know?
Right.
So I actually expected it to be discussed a little more than it even was.
Yeah. Well, they go over and that is one thing. The dynamic of so first they brought in the Irish.
Mm-hmm.
But by the time Jurgis and them get there, you notice the Irish are the they're in the police.
Yeah. Police
unions.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the bosses are Irish. So like, you know, then they're the next wave of the Lithuanians and Poles. And then he mentions that after us will come Slovaks and Bohemians, which I don't know where Bohemia is. I guess,
yeah,
I thought Bohemia was in Germany. But so like there's just, and then of course you see later, like, and where the racial spot is.
Bohemia at the time you would want to leave because World War One was brewing and that was still part of the Austro-Hungarian empire.
Okay.
So it's not, it wasn't Germany yet. It was at an empire that everybody knew was on its last legs.
I got you.
And you know, the Bohemians fled over to try and avoid a war. And then the U.S. said, all right, you're going to fight on our side and put them in uniform. That's what happened. Interestingly enough, you know, folks talk, you were mentioning the Irish came first and so many of the Irish came right around, you know, the Civil War and right afterwards. And, you know, a lot of folks talk about how it's interesting, how at first the Irish are not really seen as part of this greater American society. But then as, you know, you have more and more immigrants coming over, they just kind of have to expand the definition of white to include the Irish and the Italians and what have you. You know, we had an episode where we talked about H.P. Lovecraft and how hyper specific his racism was. And he was like, if you weren't like an Anglo, that was, whatever.
It was very specific.
So they were another breed, but, of hyper specific in their bigotry, but that's kind of the situation we're like looking at here. And, you know, and he's in this, and that's another thing that divides people is they don't have like a common language. They don't have common, he has to teach himself to read. He has to teach, he has to learn all these things. And that's also a challenge. And that's a challenge, you know, if you want to try and organize, you know, migrant workers in the United States, you know, if you think about it, actually the Supreme Court just said that was illegal a year ago, but, you know, which lost over case 8-1. They voted that you couldn't do union organizing in California farms. You know, we'll see about that though. That's all I'll say, but, shoot. Okay. So anyway, to just hop, to get it rolling a little more. And again, this book is all just kind of it's thing after thing after
it's
thing.
It's rough. Yeah. Just rough. One after another.
I honestly didn't read it as fast as I normally read stuff just because I was like, I'm not reading more than a couple chapters of this.
I had to, there was one part where I had to put it down for a couple of days.
It's bad. He has a moment where his Ona gets sexually assaulted by her boss, Connor. Was the her boss's name, and he goes in and Jurgis goes and beats the hell out of Connor, and he goes to jail for what, like 30 days or something like that.
Yeah, I think he does 30. Yeah,
and he does 30 days plus like expenses.
Oh yeah, that's what it was, 30 days, and he doesn't realize that he has to work off
another few
extra for the time he is rooming.
And the crazy thing is, he's like in prison, he actually does a little bit better. He like he's able to like rest, and so it's he gets a little bit of his muscle back and stuff like that. But he says like the cage is he's locked out, his family is locked out from, you know, stuff. And when he gets back, his family's been evicted, and you know, Ona is you know, she dies shortly afterwards. She was pregnant, she has a premature birth, and she dies in childbirth. And even while he's trying to take care of her, there's some lady haggling in his ear about how much money she's got to give him. He's got to give her to like make it worth her while, and she doesn't And she doesn't have any particular hurry and she doesn't do anything. And after the wife dies, she says, yeah, it's your fault for not calling a doctor. Don't think you're going to get away with not paying me. Like, it's just like the money is still on around his neck while he's
like
doing
all
that.
The time. Like, he has no time to really process anything before, you know, people are just at him for money. Like,
yep.
Ugh, man.
And then, so yeah, he keeps hanging up there, and he struggles on, and he has a, and yeah, he's like doing other work. He's doing what he can. I think he briefly has a job at like a half decent factory that then immediately closes down, making like wheat threshers or something like that.
Yep.
And then, you know, one day he gets back and his son, you know, who is like really the last person he really cares about. I mean, like he probably cares about Maria and Elzbieta a little bit, but like he really cares about his son the most, Anatis, and his son drowns in the street, because in the springtime in Chicago, waters used to rise and the waters used to come and fill the street, and it would come under these rotted boards, and he would fall, and the kid fell in and drowned. And I mean, God, man.
Yeah, that was one thing they mentioned in the beginning too, when they're describing the place that they live, and how there was how runoff just kind of made these giant channels.
And I looked it up. This happened. Like, this was not. This happened fairly regularly. Actually,
yeah, it's insane.
And it's like, you know, like, and he's just a kid who's a couple of years old, you know, like or maybe 3 years
he's
old.
He's toddling.
Not, you know, it's not like this is, you know, a grown kid, but yeah. And and nobody has time to watch him. They're working and stuff like that, even though younger kids are hawking newspapers.
Yep.
And then that's the point where Jurgis is like, I'm going to be a hobo. Like, fuck this.
That's where I had to put it down to.
Yeah,
once little Antonis got it in the street, because the way when he gets home,
like, it's so just sudden.
It's just like, fuck, man.
Nothing good can happen to this man.
My wife, she heard the God damn it, like God damn it, man. And I put the book down. I'm gonna quit for a couple days.
it's crazy because I thought about the fact that this was written and these chapters are broken down by how they serialized it. I believe in the magazine.
That makes
sense,
yeah.
Man, I'm just imagining you read the latest edition of The Jungle and you're just like, oh, come on.
Yes. Stop it, man. Fuck, we get it. Mm. Oh, man. Yeah.
And then Jurgis, he goes on, he just has some misadventures, man. He spent some time as a tramp, and he has like some, yeah, good times, but like he's got some times where he's like sleeping and somewhere that's warm, and every now and then he gets to have a good meal, and he doesn't have to stress about other people, and he really buries his familial instinct. He really just becomes really animalistic, and you know, he has a period where this is kind of weird. I don't really even know what the point was, but the son of the owner of the first factory where Jurgis works, he runs into him on the street, and the kid takes him home and gets him drunk. And then passes out and he gets thrown out with $100 bill in his pocket, which is worth about $3,000 today. So it was good money.
That's a weird scene. Yeah.
Yeah. And I had to check, but yeah, it's the son of the first factory worked at the beef place.
Okay.
So that nice house. And I mean, it's, you know, it's obviously once again, him being unsubtle at all, but like taking Jurgis through the house and telling him how much everything cost and shit, man.
God damn.
But you know, it's real, you know, it's, of course, he kind of like, you know, maybe bent over backwards to make Jurgis get in the house and make that scene work, but like, and then Jurgis gets the $100 stolen from him.
God damn it.
Cannot catch a break.
But that what is interesting about this section, I think, is Jurgis's real transition into sort of like his breaking, you know, like his transition to just accepting this individualist mindset, like a really hardcore individualist mindset. Yep. And the quote that I really liked was, so he went on tearing up all the flowers from the garden of his soul and setting his heel upon them.
Mm.
And this whole section, there was so I was waiting for him to really go over the edge and do something really fucked up. You know what I mean? Like, that's what I like about this section is like, how far will he take that aspect, you know? And because these, you know, these books from the, these kind of stories from back in the day, you know, you never know, something real fucked up might come along. And it already been
really
up, so
he does bad stuff, but he really, I think, gets saved from the worst of it by being a dumbass. Like, maybe not even a dumbass, but by not thinking, you know,
he's just simple. Yeah.
Because he goes to jail and he meets this guy, Jack DeJuan, who he had run into before. And Jack DeJuan's kind of this suave. He describes himself as a safe picker, but he mostly just beats people over the head and takes their money.
He ain't cracking no fucking
safe. It's funny because when he first describes himself, he's like, yeah, I'm a guy, I slip in. And then all he does is just, he's a pickpocket, which I thought that was kind of funny. I don't know if there's any good movies of this, but you could have a pretty good, like, I'm trying to imagine like a pretty good actor could like be pretty suave with Jack and be a pretty, pretty fun performance. Because he's just, you know, he really sells himself as a worldly man. And he doesn't really know anything Jurgis doesn't know, except he just met the people sooner. But him and Jurgis, they kind of just, they have a period where they're, you know, robbing people together. And then robbing people, turns out, if you know the right people, you can make more money doing that. And turns out, if you know the right people who are robbing people, you can meet the police. And if you meet the police, you can meet the guy who's running the Democratic Party. And all of a sudden, Jurgis becomes a politician, not the guy running, but he becomes a guy who's helping the Democrats and helping the Republicans or making deals under the table. And you got this whole sham election that Jurgis helps run, and he's making money, and he ends up getting a job. He gets off the blacklist he was put on for beating up Connor, and he ends up getting a job working as basically not like a boss, but like, you know,
supervisor,
middle management at one of the, basically the same place he was working before in the meat place. Easier job, more money. He's, you know, drinking as much as he wants, just acting a fool. He robs people without any, you know, he's finally just like, I'm going to do what I'm going to do. And that's the time when you have Jurgis, you know, finally, you know, he kind of has his Willem era, because the folks go on strike. Finally, I'm like, finally, I'll go on strike. God, the folks go on strike, and he becomes a scab, you know. And he finds out immediately how well it pays to be a scab during the strike. he gets paid. He asks for money, and he realizes as soon as after he's asked for all the money he can dream of, he could ask for more.
And then really ain't got to do much of shit.
No, he doesn't have to do work. And he starts grafting folks who work at the factory, the folks who are working there. He'll be like, well, you give me a buck and, you know, you can do this or that, or you can knock off early. And he's really making really good money. I mean, I did the math. And if you did it for inflation, I mean, he's talking about having accounting for inflation, about 10 grand in the bank, which, woo, I mean, like, that's good money, you know, like, especially for a dude who was just homeless.
And he's got no ties. Yeah, he's just kind of, because the whole time he's just kind of going from spot to spot, sleeping wherever he's drinking.
Yeah, and now he's got 300 something in the bank. It's, yeah, like I said, adjust for inflation, about 10 grand. He's you know, he's got a good job prospects or whatever. Yeah, but people hate him for good reason.
Yeah.
The union hates him. You know, and he's working with the police, and, you know, he's doing all of that. And the only reason he doesn't just become a complete, you know, creature of the bosses is because he happens to run into that Connor fella again. And he once again, and it's kind of darkly funny. The first time he fights him, he bites him on the cheek and rips out a piece of a cheek. And the second time he fights him, he does it again on the other side.
That's one of the things I love about that character, I think, and how those scenes go down. Is like how animalistic they make him, and like how realistic the fight seems.
Oh yeah,
that, because he doesn't talk about the bite. He mentions that as he is pulled away, some of the man's face is in his fucking teeth.
Yeah, he doesn't know. He's going nuts on him. Yeah, he's pulling hair and stuff. And I like that. And I like that Connor can't fight for anything. That's pretty fun. Like, he just twice gets absolutely rocked, handled. And it's not like, and Jurgis just kind of walks off. Walks what he it gets. Off.
Fucking bastard.
And you know, Jurgis, but that basically lands him in jail again, and Connor happens to be in with the right people that he can't get off. And so basically Yurgis gets out, has to give away basically all the money he has to his name on bail. He's homeless again.
Well, the times in jail too, I think, being that it is described as more comfortable than his life outside. And also he really starts to learn. Where that transformation, I think, it means a lot to me because this is probably the closest parallel to my life and what I, the things that I went through. Doing really shady stuff. Which, if you don't, folks that don't know me, I'm a felon. And I got that way being poor and doing shady shit to eat, it pushed me to that, I got to get mine, however I got to get it. And even though I was doing something horrible that still to this day, stealing stuff out of rich folks' vacation houses, whatever, I don't really feel too bad about that. Yeah. But selling pills and stuff to my friends, so a lot of them aren't alive today. Once you make those choices and once you get in and do that, and what it does to your soul is how it describes it in here. How it perfectly aligns you to be a capitalist almost.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like that's what, I think my favorite quote in the whole book was from when he was in jail.
You want to go ahead and read it then?
Yeah. Let me do this one here. Let me see where, this, okay. So he's in jail talking about, he's talking about the other folks in jail that he's, meeting. Quote, "They could tell the whole hateful story of it, set forth in the inner city of the inner soul of a city in which justice and honor, women's bodies and men's souls were for sale in the marketplace. And human beings writhed and fought and fell upon each other like wolves in a pit, in which lusts were raging fires and men were fuel, and humanity was festering and stewing and wallowing in its own corruption. Into this wild beast tangle, these men had been born without their consent. They had taken part in it because they could not help it. That they were in jail was no disgrace to them, for the game had never been fair. The dice were loaded. They were swindlers and thieves of pennies and dimes, and they had been trapped and put out of the way by swindlers and thieves of millions of dollars." End quote.
Yeah, man, I wrote that one down too, because that is a hell of a quote.
That hits for me so fucking hard, man. I get chills because I know that feeling, and I know what it means. Like when that clicks in your head, to have experienced it, and to feel that that's the way everybody feels about you, and to lean into it, and then to go do some really fucked up shit that you regret for the rest of your life because of it, Whew, god damn. Got all over.
Yeah, man. Yeah, man. And it's absolutely right. He falls into that, but it makes that important contradiction of he's thrown, they're thrown in there by folks that are even millions.
Right.
They're thrown in there by the Democrats and Republicans running the city, by the beef trust and the oil trust and the rail trust and all these rich folks.
That's just it. They have to trick you into thinking that you can, make it too, thinking that you can be a hustler too. They have to trick you into thinking that, but what you don't realize is you can never be that. They started off with the bag, you may get close enough to start smelling it. You may get to rub elbows with them. You may get to get them some dope every once in a while or whatever, but that's it. That's all you're ever going to get out of it.
Best case scenario for Yurgis financially is he doesn't have his inner thing with Connor, and he spends the rest of his life, being comfortable, and he's going to be an alcoholic who everybody hates.
Right.
And everybody cusses under their breath. And at some point he's probably going to be Connor and getting his face bitten off by somebody. And he's probably going to deserve it if he goes down that path.
He's probably going to get shanked.
Yeah.
He's
probably going to deserve it.
Yep.
And that's the thing. And that's absolutely, that's his best option. not to become the CEO. That's never going to happen. Mm-hmm. Jurgis is never going to be the CEO. He's never going to be the judge. He's never going to, he'll always be at their mercy. You know, he's never going to have a thing without, you know, but he could, it, so that's exactly right. It's that lie. It's that situation. And he's kind of, you know, he's kind of rescued from that by, not by poverty, but by, you know, getting kind of knocked to his senses.
Yeah.
Which I was, you know, it would have been a powerful ending to have Jurgis end as a villain, but man, I'm glad he doesn't, because
I am too.
I love this guy. You know, at the end of the day, he does some, you know, fucked up stuff throughout the course of the book, but all
it
things
could have been so much worse.
Oh, it could have been so much worse.
So much worse.
There are so many moments I was like, he's about to just.
Me too. I thought the violence against a woman was going to happen. I
oh
knew
yeah.
I knew
it,
he was.
It really
was
did.
Gonna get real bad, and
it doesn't. It doesn't. Yeah, he has some ladies that after his wife. You know, his wife dies, it like sort of implies he has a relationship with, but it never gets to that point. If that had been included, it would have been a sort of situation where I would have understood why they included it. That wouldn't have been unrealistic.
Right.
But like, for the fact, just my own personal, like, I like Jurgis. I want to see him like be redeemable.
He's had enough. Let's redeem
his soul at the least. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
You know, it talks about how, is there a hog God who like cares about him? That's kind of how I'm feeling. Like, man, yeah. Somebody think of Jurgis.
Oh, my boy. Damn.
Yeah. It's honestly, I keep thinking of Job, like the biblical book of Job throughout this. And it just keeps getting tested. And, unlike Job, he doesn't kind of get given everything at the end. You know, he doesn't end up a rich man or anything. But speaking of, we'll kind of, there's not a whole lot of book left. So just the strike ends, and the strike ends, and they get a contract, and then the company immediately says, psych, was crossing my fingers, and pulls the rug out from under him. And Jurgis is kind of, you know, gone. He's not part of that, but you know, that's chaos. There's like chaos there, and people are losing faith in the unions and this, that, and the other. And Jurgis manages to find Maria, and she has become a prostitute to sort of feed herself and to feed the family. And Maria is even, and it even said, I think she's addicted to heroin now.
Yeah.
And that doesn't have a positive resolution. It she just says, I'm addicted. I'm always going to be addicted. I'm never getting out. This is who I am.
Yeah.
And even a situation where he's like, well, we're not going to take your money like from this. And he's like, well, she's like, well, I'll just spend it on more heroin and more alcohol and more bullshit here. Like, it's that's like a bleak thing. And it talks about, you know, it has a moment where it talks about, you know, the sex trade. It talks about these women who were brought in. They don't necessarily know they're going to be prostitutes or whatever. They're told they have this, and then they get trapped, and then they're told they're indebted and they can't leave. And, you know, there's
and literally
threat of violence.
Brought into for a job. That's what blew my mind, is they are told in these places, they're like, no, you're gonna come paint cans or whatever.
Yep. And then that happens.
Fruit. Yeah.
And then they drug them.
Yep.
Yep. And they get them addicted, and they get them, you know, they're under threat, and maybe they don't speak the language. You know, they know specifically they're pretty much all foreign girls. And that's still how you know the sex trade works. It is primarily folks who don't speak the language, who are forced to be addicted to drugs. I mean, you know, we know we've unfortunately over the last few years had to learned a lot about how all that shit works, and we know it still goes on at all levels. So that's a thing, you know, that she's going through. And he even asks, well, how's the guy that you were going to marry? And she says, well, man, he can't even fiddle anymore. He lost his fingers. And it's like, man, I was so,
they didn't have to throw that in.
Yeah, there's a throwaway line too. It's like, man, did you really have to?
God,
really? Yeah.
And then also the talking about, you know, the conversation of how good sex work is, how they have such a cold conversation.
Yeah.
About how they all could have been fine if they could have just got Ona to do it.
Yeah.
And it's just like, fuck, man. There's
how much money they could have been in it, you know?
How they talk about it, you know, just so, it's
cavalierly, rough. But they're like, we could have saved this, that. That's the situation. But Jurgis, you know, it's here where he just kind of has his accidental moment where you kind of have the redemption, or if not the redemption or the positive turn, the promise of the future. You have Jurgis, and this is the part that in some censored versions was cut out. I don't know how it ended originally. I guess just like making the reader want to jump off a cliff. I don't know.
Jesus.
Like, I don't know like what you expect, but the Jurgis, basically he just goes into a warm hall because he's like, oh, they're having some kind of come to Jesus rally or political thing or something where I can get out of the cold for a minute. Because he talks about having gone to these events before of various things. He talks about how, there's a brief part where he talks about going to a church event just to get out of the cold.
Soup or something. Yeah, that's
It actually has a great quote where it says, quote, they were trying to save their souls, and who but a fool could fail to see that all was the matter with their souls was that they had not been able to get a decent existence for their bodies. you know, and you know, just the very literal thing. And it's but Jurgis has this, he attends this rally. And it turns out to be a socialist meeting, and he doesn't really know much about the socialist side. They're some third way political force. They're this third group that can't be bought off. And you just have this, you know, this guy who's like ranting and talking about the future and possibilities. And Jurgis is nodding off until the lady there, and it is he calls her like a lady, as in she's got money.
Yeah.
And she's like, no, like you need to listen to this comrade. And he's like, oh, I got called comrade by like, you know, lady who wouldn't look the other, wouldn't look at me twice, you know, like what's going on. And that's where you have this long speech from this guy. And, you know, and once again, there's no subtlety about it. You know, Upton Sinclair's laying his cards on the table. He's like, all right, I've subjected you to all this. Here is like the hope. Here is the possibility. And Jurgis is completely, and I'll read a quote from him in a minute, but Jurgis is completely bought. He realizes, shoot, all this exploitation is part of this system. He sees it. He sees the machinations. You know, he's been the hog walking the line, but suddenly he sees the conveyor belt, you know, like he sees it all as not isolated incidents, but as connected. And he looks at his neighbors and like, oh, they went through this too. And they went through this too. And the prostitution, that's part of it. And the crime, that's part of it. And the police, they're part of it. He sees it. He just has this like Paul on the road to Damascus, scales off the eyes moment. And man, that's, I said earlier, I was so afraid that he was going to get like screwed over by these people too. And I guess I've just been hurt so many times.
Yeah.
They really don't, you know, they can't promise him. They can't promise him anything special. You know, like they say, yeah, you're going to, well, we need your help and you're going to work and you may never see it. A better life. In fact, he didn't, you know, like Jurgis.
But the solidarity, and that's what I think was the coolest part, is him going from being broken completely, like just so like, fuck man, things are rough. And then once he hears it and then he realizes and then gets a taste of that solidarity, all of a sudden he's doing butt naked backflips, you know?
Yeah,
what I mean?
Exactly.
And he's heard.
He's reading and he's discussing. And then, you know, he ends up going to work at this for this guy who's, you know, he's a socialist and he owns like a little hotel. Not, I guess it's like a little hotel or a little lodging, and they just kind of all work to clean it together. And they all have conversations when they get a chance. And, you know, it's even funny, like it even throws in the, like, you know, it's Upton Sinclair being aware of it as a socialist, that everybody is a little bit annoyed by him at first. And it's like, yeah, fair enough. Like, Elsbieta is like, yep, sure. Whatever, Jurgis.
Yeah.
We're socialists now. Just please bring home a wage. You know, she's Elsbieta. Don't make Elsbieta get into politics. Let that woman have a nap.
She's had enough.
Get that lady a nap.
That is interesting how she handles that whole thing and how it mentions her. Just like she would hear about it many times, but that's all she would do is she would hear about it. You know, she'd go to the meeting, she'd hear about it, but that's all.
Yeah. She's not opposed. She's just at the meetings, you know, making her grocery list, you know, like it's whatever.
It's such a cool to watch how that subject gets brought up, and that word in particular, when they meet the old woman from the neighborhood in the beginning,
who was
a socialist. I can't say her last name.
Oh, I don't know.
She's such a cool character, but she's only in it for just a little bit, and I can't say her last name, so I don't know what to the granny socialist lady.
I know who you're talking about. Yeah, the older lady. And I thought that was a throwaway when I first read it. Just like, yeah, oh, but it's not
cool how she mentions it, or how that conversation gets brought up and how Jurgis reacts to it and then how she reacts to Jurgis. It's just really funny, you know. Yep. She's like, oh well, you're a fucking idiot then. Yeah. I guess. Oh man.
Yeah, yeah. And it's and you know, he meets a couple socialists and they're not like, it's not super important what the characters are, but there's like a guy by the name of it's Ostrinsky, I think, and he's a tailor, and he's like, yeah man, I'm dirt poor, but you can sleep on my kitchen floor if you need to for while the time being, like I'm not any like they take care of each other best they can, you know,
right?
And he says, look, we can't promise you anything, but like, you know, until you have work, we're not going to make you pay dues, and we're going to try and do what can. And you know, and he even has a part where it says, I loved this, and I'll read this quote. It is, and he's talking about all these working men who get together and they do the work. And it says, quote, these revolutionists were not angels. They were men, and men who would come up from the social pit and the mire of it smeared over them. Some of them drank and some of them swore and some of them ate pie with their knives. There was only one difference between them and all the rest of the populace, that they were men with a hope, with a cause to fight for and suffer for, end quote. And man, ate pie with their knives.
That's such a cool one. So good.
I got to start saying that, man.
I instantly, as soon as I read that too, I was like, I know exactly what that means.
Yeah.
I know exactly what those guys are. Like, mm-hmm. You know, that was,
it's great.
Was a lot of things you pull your pocket knife and eat with, mm-hmm. with your pocket knife where you come from, where I come from.
Yeah,
and
yeah, yeah.
Exactly what he meant by that. So,
yeah, good. The guys who, even after they got the job, they don't need to. They're just like doing it or whatever.
Yeah.
Oh, man. But yeah, it was talking about they're not like, and once again, this book always manages to avoid the trap of the noble angelic working man, you know. Yeah. the trap of and it's a trap that like a lot of like socialist literature falls into, of
right.
like this poor working man who never did a thing wrong in his life and this evil boss who communes with Satan, you know, like
right.
And it's like, no, you see why the bosses are evil and like fuck them in this book. I'm not saying they're not, and
right.
I'm just saying you see why the bosses are like, shoot, well, I'm the boss. I'm the slave driver. I'm the slave.
I'm gonna get, you know, mine.
I'm gonna, yeah, get mine. And you see why. And you see why Jurgis makes the mistakes he does. But he's making mistakes, and the dudes around him are making mistakes, and they're getting drunk, and they're doing dumb stuff,
right.
and they're gonna keep doing it. And that's like fine, because they've got like a mission, and they've got like a reason to live. And you know, the book has, it's kind of weird. The last couple chapters, there's like a long conversation between two socialists about like what socialism would look like. And I felt like it was kind of like a weird distraction, but like, it was interesting. I mean, you mentioned it earlier about the, like, sort of the fetishization of technology that one, yeah, guy has. And then, yeah, the other guy talks about it from sort of a religious angle, like revolutionary, yeah, theology, which I liked that a lot. Actually.
I did too. I
talking
like
about Jesus as the first socialist. I love that.
The father of socialism. I believe he calls him. Yeah, mm-hmm. He does. He calls Jesus the father of socialism.
And he quotes, like, he gives, like, throws quote after quote after quote out. Like, the dude is on a roll. I,
yeah,
love that.
Yeah.
He knew his business.
And the guy he's arguing with is just like, bravo.
Yeah. The guy he was arguing with came in like an online atheist, like ready to,
yeah,
just,
yeah,
ready to just be like, push up his spectacles or whatever. And he got hit with he was like, you're gonna go after the working man, the carpenter who, you know, who knocked over the money changers' tables. And he made the great point about like the churches being corrupt. And it's great because Sinclair talks about earlier in it, I read the quote about the corruption of the church. But here's, mm-hmm, the thing, he wasn't saying, oh well, you know, go to hell if you're religious or whatever. I mean, like, that's such, and that's a thing that I've dealt with just being in leftist spaces. And I'm not like, and I get people have like come from all kinds of backgrounds with religion, but people will be like, oh, that's stupid or whatever. It's like, man, you're trying to organize the working class.
Yeah,
like,
you can't have that.
That's what it is. And it's like, and also, like, you know, you really think you're better than whatever, you know.
I mean,
like, Martin Luther King Jr. is a pastor. Like, especially in American South, like, they're just, that's part of it. And like,
yep,
that's whatever you want to believe, that's fine. You know, like, I call myself a Christian personally, but like, whether you are or not, that's an aside to me. It's like that, but that narrative of Jesus as that figure is so important, and it is,
absolutely,
so central to, I mean, like, it even says in the book of, and I won't get too much on my preacher's hat here, but it even says in the book of Acts, the apostles lived in common with everybody. They,
mm-hmm,
they gave all they had, and they lived in common with each other, and they shared alike, and everybody, you know, like, did their trade when they could and spread the word when they could, you know? So like that, that works. But then there's also the other guy with this sort of more Kropotkin, he references Kropotkin, which made me laugh, vision of the world. And we're going to have technology and this, that, and the other. And it sounds a little bit like, you know, it sounds a little Silicon Valley, but like, you get it. That's just how they talk though. You know, it's
well, and again, I mean, we're talking about a time. It has to be understood what was happening in industry at the time. And like, you know, and it parallels a lot what's going on right now even. And I understand why there are so many people out here who have watched, you know, a lot of sci-fi movies, and they see people like Elon Musk and big, you know, rich money man scientist is going to take us into space and save us all. I mean, I get it. I understand, you know,
it's people, a cool vision, but it's like, man, like I and it's like, and it's not wrong per se when he says like we can harness machinery and make it work for us. Right. That's true. Yeah, like
it is.
There's not a lie about it. It's viewing it as maybe salvation that you have to be careful of, because like, no, like we have to be our own salvation, you know, like the actual, you know, collaboration between people has to be salvation. But it does make some great points of it just argues, well, look at all the waste of war and look at all the waste of all these bullshit jobs and look at all the waste of, oh, wow, you have 50 brands of everything and they're all the same, that they come all from the same factory. Yeah. And, you know, and all that really hits, you know, like the concept of like, you know, you walk into the store and you got however many brands of the same type of chip and they're all probably made by Lay's, or whatever Lay's parent company was, and this, that, and the other. The idea of like, hey, we don't have to, we waste so much, and that's on top of the fact that we don't distribute the resources well. Look at what a planned economy could be. That's really what he's pointing towards, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
And that is worth reading.
They're really going heavy into, it's really, really making it, as the novel's winding up, they are really making all of the cases and laying them all out there. It's, and some of the ways it's, you know, like particularly talking about, you know, bringing in black folk from the South, and you can see he was using white folks' fear of black folk to, you know, really try to make the case like, hey, you know, they're gonna bring the poor black folk in and they're gonna have them around your white kids. And like you could really see he tried every angle that he thought would scare the hell out of white out of folks at the time, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And then it's of course worth noting that there is that racial blind spot. I mean, you noticed, you mentioned it earlier, and you know. And I think Sinclair, if you had asked him like, oh, well, are you a racist? He probably would have denied it. He had stuff where, and he got better about it later in life, I'll say, you know, he's that doesn't excuse anything, but like, you know, when he writes about the people they bring in as strike breakers, he writes about bringing black folk in, which is a thing they would do because they would be the poor, because they would be the poorest folk.
And he writes about it, how they would have, you know,
it's the way he communicates it is kind of my rub with it.
And it's done as though he's speaking as one of the bosses or something, you know, because Jurgis at that time is, you know, doing that thing. So
And you're in part of it, and you can put part of that down to as you're working with Jurgis's mindset, and there's something to be said for character perspective. And
but
you
it's
know.
Not like he's dropping in bombs and stuff.
He has the part where like he talks about the socialists went to everyone. He mentions the African American League as one of the people that they went to, and
that was the difference in between the unions and then the socialists later. Yeah. That they were actually, you know,
they were reaching out to everybody.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there is an interesting part about, like, I wouldn't say this book is necessarily like I would say it absolutely is not anti-union. However, it has skepticism for like some union structure, right? Which is, I think, absolutely warranted because, like, look at history.
And it's the perfect place to discuss it. I mean, we're talking about Chicago.
Yeah, here, man.
Chicago unions. I mean, that's, you know, that's gangster shit.
Graft City, man.
Yeah. So,
like, go ahead. Sorry.
I was just saying that is the perfect place to, you know, to explore that kind of thing. And like you were saying, it tries to be as realistic as possible. It shies away from, you know, a lot of the savior type shit. And I think it gives a pretty good realistic view of it.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, the union even lets Jurgis down to an extent when he gets his injury, not to an extent, they let him down. And it is interesting, 'cause you like, look at, you know, how history went. Right. And you see in the 1930s, you have this mass movement that includes socialists, you includes communists. And because of the conditions, it was right or wrong, a lot of them considered it right to throw in their lot with this sort of progressive movement that
right.
encapsulated, you know, people like FDR and stuff. And they had this vision of, oh, well, after this alliance, we'll get our day. We'll win at the polls or whatever. And this book even has some of that. Well, we're going to get elected. Now it doesn't say we're going to get elected and then it's over. But it does have that, like, well, we'll win the election and we'll this, that, and the other. And what happens is in real life, yeah, they win some reforms, but from the perspective of, say, the Democrats, the liberals, they see it as kind of a buying off of the working class, right? Mm-hmm. They see it as things like the GI Bill and things like Social Security. They see it as, all right, we can content these people, because the alternative is we get strung up like the hogs.
Revolution.
Turning them into. Yeah.
Yep.
Now, the alternative is Russia, you know, like what happened in Russia. The alternative is what's happening in China. That's what they saw. And that's kind of what happened. And then you see, you know, World War II is obviously this complicated situation. Mm-hmm. And then where, you know, a lot of folks have to throw in their lot together, former enemies working together for understandable reason, because you got the closest thing to just pure evil ever existed in human history. You're fighting in the form of Hitler. But then after that, all that is to say, you finally get in 1948, the Taft-Hartley Act, right? And the Taft-Hartley Act is the act that strips all union labor of anyone who identifies as socialist or communist. It makes them illegal to be in any kind of union leadership role, right? And at that moment, the unions had to decide whether they were going to fight or whether they were going to keep on with electoral politics, right? Because they had been winning. Here's the thing. They had been winning. They had been getting stuff that they wanted. Dang. And so they gave up the communists, they gave up the socialists, and guess what? All that fire was gone.
Gone.
And that's when you see the turn, and that's when you talking about mob bosses and the unions and what's his name, Jimmy Hoffa and shit.
Yep,
they come in, and the government's just fine with them coming in. And that's kind of where you see the radical union movement start to taper off in the 40s and 50s. And that's not to say there's not been some incredible union struggles, or to discount any of that or anything like that. I'm just saying the
mechanisms were working.
Right. They were on this.
Down. Yeah.
And that's where you stop seeing this sort of progress, this push in one direction. And it's because the unions weren't able to, you know, synthesize that. And you see sort of the echoes of that in this book. And it's a thing we're still living with and a thing we're still dealing with. And, you know, America's now got one of the lowest unionization rates of any country in the world. And we're seeing that change, you know, and fingers crossed, we're going to keep seeing that change because people are going to keep fighting for it. Unions are actually, I'll say, I saw a stat the other day, unions are more popular now than they have been since the 1940s. So
it does feel like, you know, at least with younger folk, my experience, my age group, I come from, and also coming from the South, like where it is very anti-union.
Yeah, very.
You know, no matter what. So it's still a little, it feels weird to me. It feels like people are talking about it a lot more. That could just be because I come from the nutsack of Alabama, though. You know what I mean? So I don't know.
It's just, you know, and it's, that's one of those things where it's a struggle. It's a fight, you know, it doesn't sort of happen all at once. But yeah, we are in an era now where, you know, and like we were talking about cycles, you know, we are in an era now where things have cycled around this sort of, you know, thing that was in the air in the early 1900s of, well, this thing's going to hit a wall, you know?
Yeah.
And to keep it from hitting a wall, what did they do? Well, they had to make the Federal Reserve, and they had to pass laws breaking up some of the trusts. Not because Teddy Roosevelt was some bleeding heart socialist, but because he was a capitalist who was like, we got to keep this thing on the rails.
Figure it out. Yeah.
They had to pass minimum wage laws. They had to do this. And that shit is getting stripped away because it's finally like just the Terminator skeleton is all that's left. You know? and it's burning away all the fat.
Yep.
And now that same conflict is back, and we're going to, for better
and
or worse,
global.
We're gonna
see it. It's global. It's global now too.
Everywhere.
Like that, you know, I know you saw that video the other day of the fella in I believe he was in the Congo digging his friends out of this collapsed illegal mine.
Yeah, man.
all of our big tech solutions and all of our big climate solutions and all of our fancy technology is all of it only is possible because those dudes are over there doing that.
Yep. Yep. So, and it's the cobalt and lithium and absolutely. And it's a situation where it's like, even the best quote unquote folks on the liberal end in our current system, Green New Deal folks, they don't have any answer for that.
Nope.
You know, they're like, nah, well, you know, they're going to
don't really talk about that. That's basically what you get. Like, well, mm-hmm. we got to do it. It's got to be done. You said, you know, technology's got to progress somehow.
Mm-hmm.
Fuck, man.
And that's the interesting thing. And that's the contradiction. And that's the fight that we find ourselves engaged in. And, you know, we see ourselves and, you know, a lot of things have gotten better, but there's also we see declines. And another thing we see is we see a pretty freaky horizon if we don't get things changed.
Yeah.
You know, that's part of that is war. Part of that is greed. A big part of that is climate. That's a thing that, you know, you don't have in the jungle. You don't have this specter of climate apocalypse, but you do have this feeling. It is interesting though, because like this feeling of all pervasive doom though, is
you do,
there.
I would say there's hint. And it, what kept striking me is how it reminded me of a lot of the cyberpunk stuff I read.
Sure.
When he's first describing the stockyards and the industrial food system and describing the literal climate around it.
Yeah.
Is all extreme. And all of the extremes of weather in that area were
That's
all
true.
Made worse because, you know,
no green.
Yeah, there's no green. There's nothing to catch the water. There's the snow drifts, the clouds, the constant pouring mm-hmm. of smoke and what they're all breathing in all the time and how it sticks to the walls and the houses. Mm-hmm. You know, it wouldn't be very hard to just, you know, extrapolate that and like, you know, if you could have planted a seed in Upton's head at that time, like, hey, when they build these things everywhere, you know,
yeah.
what are you going to do to the environment of
exactly
everywhere, you know,
and they did, and they yeah. are, and they, yeah. And it's a, and you know, man, some of that struck home because, you know, and I won't get too much into it because this isn't a current events podcast, but man, I live in Atlanta and if yep. I don't know what time y'all, I don't know what you listener, I don't know when you're listening to this, but if it's a long time removed, look up, you look up about climate related stuff in Atlanta and about April 2023 because yeah. things are popping off here over this cop city and them tearing down the forest. And when we don't know that's there's a live struggle, we don't know what's going to go, but that's it's a similar situation of it. It
Those
makes
big,
everything worse.
Rivers in the streets.
Oh man,
that are in the jungle.
It's coming.
That's
I mean,
what
dude,
will be in Atlanta,
dude, a county not far from here, and this isn't connected to that specifically, but it just massively flooded because we're having these freak storms now, mm-hmm. and their dams and stuff. Their infrastructure is not built for that. They're just it's built for weather that's just not.
Yep.
Is not following the patterns anymore. So it's that kind of situation, you know, it's that live question. But when you introduce that chaos to the system, you know, when you introduce uh-huh. that heat to it, that's also when you have the opportunity to, you know, bring people through. That's when you have the opportunity yep. to have solidarity. And the question right. is whether we're going to do it or not, because it's not, you know, predetermined. It's not magic, you know, and the victories that we got, you know, didn't just happen, you know, like the things that did improve were won by the blood of our grandparents and great grandparents, you know,
yeah.
like,
yeah,
they were won at places like Blair Mountain. They were won in the streets. They were won. And they're going to have to continue to be fought for, and new victories are going to have to be won. And you know, I can't tell you, like I say, our tagline for this show is the show that cares about good fiction and changing the world. And it's, and you know, And at the end of that, this if book is 100 years old and it feels timely. And at the end of the day, I just I think that's like the message that we kind of have to crawl away from it with. Crawl away, I say, because you're going to be exhausted at the end.
Yeah,
of this,
that's what I was going to say is what I'm really coming away with. And like and especially how Jurgis ended his situation or how the book ended with sort of this contentment and the solidarity. And celebrating the solidarity, the camaraderie, because sometimes that's all we're going to get. Sometimes all we're going to get is, to prepare for that next battle is the solidarity in the meantime, to nourish us, because you have to focus on that. You have to find a way to really, sustain yourself, with that, because it's ugly and it'll get worse before it gets better.
Absolutely.
a lot of the time.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the situation. And that's what we're dealing with. And I guess, and I'm just even trying to think about what I haven't said, cause there's just details all through it. And I'm not going to be able to cover all of them. It's a book that I really would encourage people to read. It feels contemporary. It reads pretty contemporary. It doesn't read, I mean, it doesn't sound like it was written yesterday, but it doesn't feel dated in a way that stuff from that era tends to. It has, its style is very straightforward. It's very well written. It's very, someone once said that, someone once said Upton Sinclair had every skill in the world except humor. And it's true. There's a couple moments that made you laugh, but it's almost like just shocking.
It's black humor. Yeah. It's dark except humor.
The only thing I would say aside from that is maybe the knife eating the pie with the knife is pretty funny. But
yeah.
I don't even know if he was cracking a joke or not. I don't know. It's funny to think about, cause I know what he's saying.
But it does have interesting, I think it falls right in that in-between place of if you like stuff from the way stuff sounds written back in the day, you'll dig it. It has, it's got some cool prose in that way.
But it reads nice out loud.
Yeah, it does.
I feel like things written back then, like they tend to read really well when read, they've got a quality of just folks reading
a rhythm
it
to them.
You can kind of hear the way that he wrote it, because it was also written in a serialized form, like I was saying, so the way it was released, and he has his journalistic intention behind it, so at moments you might even say it doesn't follow the typical novel structure,
right?
And that's true, but it ultimately is trying to be an expose, and it was a pretty dang effective one, all things considered. I mean, we're still talking about it, and I mean, the meatpacking industry and stuff is still gross, but they got some stuff changed. Some stuff has been changed back, but man, there's been some progress, I'm firmly of the belief that writing can absolutely change the world, but it doesn't change the world by itself.
Right.
It's a motivator. But to do something like that with a book almost single-handedly is an incredibly impressive task.
I think you would have to give that to him on this. Like, there's nobody can say that this book didn't do some shit.
Oh yeah. In a very literal sense, the classic, and obviously people talk about pen is mightier than the sword, all that. All I'm saying is whatever you take away from that, I'm glad to have the Food and Drug Administration telling me, telling me, hey, there's a walnut in here, so I don't make a fool of myself in a restaurant, choking, whatever.
So,
man, do you have any other thoughts? Cause I have a quote that I want to kind of read us out on, but if you have any other thoughts or anything else you want to like shoot back and forth about.
I think we pretty well covered everything that I wanted to cover. There's a lot to it, like you said. We've been at it a while, but I just feel like I would just encourage everybody to read this. Mm-hmm. Even if you are not, even if you don't call yourself a socialist, I would definitely. And if you're somebody who has never read, I would encourage people who haven't read a lot of socialist literature, who haven't read Marx, or who haven't, really dug into that kind of stuff. If you're just new to those ideas or whatever, this is a good book to get into it, I think.
And it's worth noting, Jurgis hasn't read any Marx, right. I mean, like, yeah, that's the important thing. You just have to be able, the idea of communicating these simple ideas. And it also just works very effectively as just a period piece as well, getting inside the head of someone a long time ago, but not that it's a long time ago, but at the same time, it's not all that far removed from us. It's
right.
Just a couple generations, and it would do us well to remember that. So
absolutely.
I want to read us out on a quote from the speaker who really woke Jurgis up, both literally and figuratively, who gave Jurgis hope in life, and hopefully he can give us some hope as we're as we read it off, and then we'll call it a day, because we've been at this about 2 hours now, which is good yeah, conversation.
Absolutely.
All right, here it is, and it's a little context. This man's speaking to the hall, and he says, "Do any of you really believe the world can continue how it is?" This isn't a quote, it's just generally. And he says, "Do you really believe, you know, the ruling class can just continue to hold the world forever and nothing will change? Like, can you look at the current?" And I do ask this to people all the time, by the way, just as an organizing thing. Mm-hmm. "Do you really think the conditions we have now in 50 years are going to be like that?" No, everyone knows shit's going to change.
Yeah.
For better or worse. That's a live question. But he says that, right? And then he says, "Do you believe it's going to change?" And everyone says, "Yeah, you know, of course, call and response." And then he says this, quote, "And if this is ever to be, how is it to be? What power is there that will bring it about? Will it be the task of your masters, do you think? Will they write the charter of your liberties? Will they forge you the sword of your deliverance? Will they marshal you the army and lead it by the fray? Will their wealth be spent for the purpose? Will they build colleges and churches to teach you? Will they print papers to herald your progress and organize political parties to guide and carry on the struggle? Can you not see that the task is your task, yours to dream, yours to resolve, yours to execute? That if ever it is carried out, it will be in the face of every obstacle that wealth and mastership can oppose, in the face of ridicule and slander, of hatred and persecution, of the bludgeon and the jail. That it will be by the power of your naked bosoms, opposed to the rage of oppression, by the grim and bitter teaching of blind and merciless affliction, by the painful gropings of the untutored mind, by the feeble stammerings of the uncultured voice, by the sad and lonely hunger of the spirit, by seeking and striving and yearning, by heartache and despairing, by agony and sweat of blood. It will be by money paid for with hunger, by knowledge stolen from sleep, by thoughts communicated under the shadow of the gallows. It will be a movement beginning in the far off past, a thing obscure and unhonored, a thing easy to ridicule, easy to despise, a thing unlovely, wearing the aspect of vengeance and hate, but to you, the working man, the wage slave, calling with a voice insistent, imperious, with a voice that you cannot escape wherever upon the earth you may be, with the voice of all your wrongs, with the voice of all your desires, with the voice of your duty and your hope of everything in the world that is worthwhile to you, the voice of the poor demanding that poverty shall cease, the voice of the oppressed pronouncing the doom of oppression, the voice of power wrought out of suffering, of resolution crushed out of weakness, of joy and courage born in the bottomless pit of anguish and despair, the voice of labor despised and outraged, a mighty giant lying prostrate, mountainous, colossal, but blinded, bound, and ignorant of his strength. And now a dream of resistance haunts him, hope battling with fear, until suddenly he stirs and a fetter snaps and a thrill shoots through him to the farthest ends of his huge body, and in a flash the dream becomes an act. He starts, he lifts himself, and the bonds are shattered, the burdens roll off him, he rises, towering, gigantic, he springs to his feet, and he shouts in his newborn exultation." End quote.
Woo.
Yep. And woo. I can't say anything to top that. So, hey, y'all have a good week. I appreciate y'all for listening to The Socialist Shelf. And, you know, I'll back on next time for some more conversation about changing the world and good literature. Y'all have a good one.